Welcome to Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Talk of the Bay comes your way Monday through Thursday at 5 o'clock on KSQD, and I'm your Thursday host, Rachel Ann Goodman. Today, we'll be hearing about predatory lending practices targeting the poorest residents of our community and how one group is fighting back and how you can be more economically literate so you can help your friends and neighbors not fall prey to people who have no scruples. Then we'll have a visit with incoming Chancellor Cindy LaReeve, recorded by the folks from Santa Cruz Local. And to top it off, we'll be hearing from the folks at the U.S. Census Department. What are they doing to prepare for the census? And how is counting everyone possible? And how is it important? We'll be hearing from Tori Del Favaro from the United States Census Bureau. All that and more on Talk the Bay. And for our first segment, we're going to be taking a look at the scum of the earth that prey upon people's financial needs. And I don't want to name names, but some of these lending institutions will take advantage of people by issuing payday loans, which have exorbitant interest rates, leaving people horribly in debt. In fact, the debt crisis in our country is probably one of the least covered tragedies of our financial story here after the recession. Many people did not recover and are still paying off ridiculously high loans. That's the topic on the first segment here of Talk of the Bay. And to talk about that with me is someone who thinks a lot about economics and how people are impacted by it on a daily basis, how your checkbook is impacted. Her name is Maria Cadenas, and she's executive director of Santa Cruz Community Ventures. And she has spent a lot of time helping people improve their financial stability and economic development in areas across the U.S. that may not be as wealthy as this one. Her work has spanned local and global efforts in various fields, including agriculture, tech, nonprofits, and philanthropy. She's got an interesting background that ranges from creative writing to business administration, which I find fascinating connection. So welcome to Talk of the Bay, Maria.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So I know you have a lot of big ideas for fixing this situation, but let's describe it first and why you're moved to try to help people with it. What is your definition of predatory lending? It sounds like someone's preying on someone else.
Well, that's actually the very good summary, right? It's about somebody either using false tactics or pressure tactics to secure loans without fully disclosing what the client is getting into. Some of them do it by hiding the interest rates and by saying, hey, you're only going to pay so much a day, but not talking about the full 300% interest rate that the person is going to be having. There's different types of predatory lenders. So some circles you might hear it referred to as alternative lenders, lenders outside of traditional financial institutions such as banks or credit unions.
So what are payday lenders and are they legal?
They are legal. And in fact, California has some of the weakest laws in terms of how we oversee predatory lending in the state. So the fact is that they exist and they're legally present. What we need to remember, though, is that they tend to prey on people and are designed specifically to keep people coming back to them so that you end one loan and you roll into another one. So it's a perpetual repeating of abuse, if you will, of the client that comes through the door. What we see is that they are very much overly representative in low-income communities and communities of color. And just recently, we did a study with UCSC, we call it Mamas con Mas, where we tried to map out where the predatory or alternative lenders in Santa Cruz were at. We looked at the city of Santa Cruz and the city of Watsonville. And what we found was there was three times the number of alternative lenders in Watsonville versus Santa Cruz County.
Wow. That's disheartening. And are there any kinds of laws covering their lending practices, if not to outlaw them totally? What kinds of oversight right now exists?
It depends on the type of size of the loan that you seek. So for example, right now in California, there's an assembly bill that's trying to pass that would limit the interest rate to about 36% for loans from $2,500 to $10,000 because there's no coverage right now. There is a law that prohibits any loans up to $2,500 for no higher than 36% interest rate. So what happens in these predatory situations is that the lender will offer $20,501 so they can charge higher interest rates. So there are some protections. They're just not enough, and they're split, which is why you have this state policies change from state to state. Like the state of Colorado is trying to do something. We have like the city of Gilroy, who passed something that limited temporarily the number of more that were allowed to come into the city. So there's things that city and counties can do, as well as states. At the federal level, there's work right now, I believe, to try to limit the number for credit card lenders. That's trying to be a bipartisan effort. And this really is a bipartisan question, is how do we protect the consumer so that they can participate in the economy without being burdened and led into poverty?
Let's talk about how these payday lenders work a little more detail. Give us a, you know, typical person scenario. Why do they come, you know, in the first place?
So during the study for Mamas con Mas, for example, we talked to a lot of low-income moms, and they would talk about, you know, you need to pay the rent. You need to pay the rent, and you haven't received your paycheck yet, and you just need $500. So there's no easy way to get $500 in a small loan through a bank. So you just go to the corner store and you get your $500 and then you pay the rent. And then next time you get paid, you try to pay it off, you know, if you can. And if not, it just keeps rolling, right? And if you look at the income limit of or the incomes of those households, it's hard for them to fully repay the loan. So then they take out another loan to make up for the balance that they have outstanding. And they try to pay off that one. And it just keeps accumulating over time, where the $500 loan becomes a debt that they end up paying $5,000 over the life of the loan.
That's amazing. And what are the penalties if you don't pay it at all? Like, what do they do to people who don't pay or default? There must be quite a high default rate if what you're describing is true.
Right. So where the question is that these businesses are making money anyway, right? They're going to get their $500, but they're going to try to keep getting more money out of it. And the money that they don't get back, they can write it off in their taxes. So the lender is fine. On the person who borrowed the loan, they get bad credit, which hurts. It could hurt even their job searches or searches for a new home. So their credit is impacted. They get harassed letters or other tactics to try to pressure payment. So there's a lot of both psychological damage as well as financial damage that prevents the family from moving forward.
Right. And can they come garnish their wages and things like that?
They can garnish their wages, garnish tax refunds, for example, that come through. So all of the ways that the company can come and seek their repayment of the debt.
36%. That's just so outrageous if you think about how much that is.
And you think about it, that is what's being offered as a way to mediate the 300% loans that are currently out there in the system.
So you're part of an organization, Community Ventures. What are you doing to combat this situation? Obviously, at the legislative level, you're probably doing some work there, but what kinds of education are you doing in the community to help people build financial security without these loans?
Our biggest conversations right now is with families to get them to understand how to be good consumers. A lot of the issues with predatory lenders is that people don't understand credit. They don't understand their options. They're not informed consumers. And there's also a lot of what we call cultural bias and barriers that prevent people from entering the traditional banking system. What we've noticed is a lot of the products that are being offered by these alternative lenders are actually products that traditional banks and credit unions actually do offer, including credit building accounts. Some predatory lenders are like jewelry shops who say, we'll build your credit if you buy this $1,000 worth of jewelry. So there are good products out there. But in the study with Mamas con Mas, there is a gap of comfort. Families don't feel, especially low-income families, don't feel that they can access their bank. They feel a little judged. There's no cultural competence in the tellers or the space. Not naming names. A lot of them are doing great work. But from the study, we know there's a lot of more work to do to make sure that we're creating banking institutions that are places people want to go to and feel welcome in participating in their financials. The other space is concern around, quite frankly, in our county, for example, is the issue of immigration and immigration status. There's no federal law that prohibits banks from accepting the ITIN or individual tax identification number for those that do not have social security number. There really is nothing preventing them from accepting it, except their own policies. And because each bank has different policies, or each credit union has different policies, it creates confusion on the consumer. And rather than risk being disclosed as not having a social security number, they don't enter into those institutions. So I think there's a lot of education that we're working on to work with traditional lenders, banks, and credit unions, share the findings that we found, as well as some of the feedback from the families on what they could do that are simple steps that will have a great impact in moving them into traditional banking. The other piece is that we're out there doing workshops and community education, including financial coaching, to help people understand what it means to have credit, what it means to know what an annual APR, you know, what is your percentage rate for that loan, to learn to read the fine print. And we're also working to create policy recommendations for city and county to look at neighboring regions that have established either limits of number of providers in the area, or looking at the interest rate available that they can actually charge within that jurisdiction. So we're working on all those angles.
That's many, many fronts for sure. And it sounds like you're also just warning them away from some of these worst characters, right? Some of the payday lenders, which are you also just saying, you know, you might want to reconsider going there? Is that, or is that overstepping what your mission is?
We don't want to tell people what to do. I mean, people have their individual liberty to seek out products that they want. We can inform and educate and tell them this may not be the best solution for you, but at the end of the day, they have the right to act and seek what they wish to seek out. One of the challenging things is that Intel or traditional banking institutions have both product and cultural competency to serve the community that is currently using alternative lenders. It makes it really hard to take away alternative lenders.
Sure.
Because it will create a hole, there'll be another black market, something sprouts out, right? So we want informed consumers, and we want culturally competent financial institutions that can serve the clients that are in this county, just like they are serving clients in other areas.
If you just joined me here on Talk of the Bay, I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. The program is Talk of the Bay on KSQID 90.7 FM. I'm speaking with Maria Cadenas. She is Executive Director of the Santa Cruz Community Ventures, an organization aiming to educate people about financial issues, especially where it comes to extraordinary high interest rates that they might be charged when they are in desperate straits. There's a bigger issue here, too, which you alluded to, but we really didn't address head on, which is just economic complete disparity in our culture, and especially in our counties, very high. We have a high poverty rate, and we also have a really big income inequality gap, where you have people barely scraping by, living 12 people to a house. And I can understand why they would be pushed into the arms of some of these characters who are preying upon their vulnerability. Do you have any ideas for how we can equalize somehow financially people's opportunities in this county and beyond?
I have many, but I think the best ideas come from the community themselves. One of the challenges we have in the county of Santa Cruz is that we have different industries at different ends of the county. We have an agricultural-based economy in the south part of the county, and we have a hospitality, tourism, and education economy on the north part of the county. Then there's some changes around tech and others that are coming in, but those are very different industries with different income ranks, if you will, and how they come in. And you're right, there's a $30,000 income gap, just an income gap between North Santa Cruz County and South Santa Cruz County. But the level of work is the same. That is the labor participation rate for for anybody in the county doesn't change. So people are working just as hard, no matter where they live, and just by where they live and the industries available, they're earning much less, right? So that's a challenge. So there's questions around income. What can we do to look at the income structures of the industries or other industries that can create greater income for the families living in the county? But the issue that Adventures were really exploring is the question of wealth. Wealth is really what we want people to be able to build, to take away the stress, to know that they can pay for the rent and the food and the health care that they need, and in that way create well-being. So at Adventures, we say, you know, we live in the system of local economies with the intent of creating spaces together with our health sector, with our education sector, where people can thrive and we're creating well-being. How do we do that? And a big part of that is wealth. Wealth building in this area is hard around house ownership. Home ownership has been traditionally being sold as a way to build your wealth. Access to home ownership in this county is very hard, whether you're low income and actually middle income right now. You just can't quite afford to buy a home or even a condo, you know. So if wealth cannot be built through home ownership, another option is business ownership. So one of the initiatives that we're really encouraging is looking at who are our current business owners who may be thinking of retiring, who may be willing to step down. And what can we do to encourage those business owners to consider a sale to their employees? Why? One, the employees know the company, they know the clients, they know the community, they share that legacy that the owner may have. And secondly, the studies have shown that when employees are owners, their income, that's income, goes up about 30%. And their wealth goes up as well, whether it's because of now they're owners, so they're looking at their 401k a little differently or whatever structures they have. So if we can do that, we want keep businesses that are local. We keep our local jobs, you know, keep people employed and build income and wealth through that shift. So we're looking really strongly at business ownership as a vehicle of wealth creation, especially small business ownership. I think Santa Cruz is poised to take advantage of that. And we want to encourage any business owner listening out there who may be thinking about it. You don't need to sell tomorrow, but you need to start thinking, how is your business going to be passed on and how can we help you do that?
Are you talking about worker cooperatives, worker-owned cooperatives in some sense?
Yes, some of them may be worker-owned cooperatives. Some may be ESOPs, so employee stock ownership models that are out there. There's different ways of creating what we're calling democratically owned businesses, where the wealth of the business, the equity of the business, is not dependent on only one sole proprietorship, right? So looking at those models will be ideal. We know they are actually great single proprietorship businesses that do a great job of looking at living wages, the benefit packages for the employees, and trying to share the wealth being created through that business.
Because the current model you see often is a worker stay at minimum wage and, you know, the boss goes on vacations frequently and just, you know, accumulates wealth for his kids, but it doesn't build it in the community necessarily. And a lot of the owners are out of the area. So your model brings it back home and gets spent here. So I can see how it would build up other businesses as well.
Yeah, we're thinking it's almost like a circular economy, but more around solidarity and really around community, right? If we all just diminish the gaps more, share more, and invest in each other as both a customer and a worker and an owner, the money stays local and we get control of our local economy. We get to decide our local future. One of the questions that I get asked a lot is, well, it's capitalism. You know, one takes all and the rest suffer. I'm like, well, that doesn't work. You know, we've been playing Monopoly for a very long time. And now everything is with hotels and most of us just want to land in jail so we don't get to pay the rent, right? So that model just doesn't work. So we have to be creative of how do we shift. And also, it's a hard model to shift to. The way to do it is to really encourage local ownership of our economy, and that includes our local businesses. How do we create that network of ownership where the owners are the ones that are working, so they put in the heart and soul? The studies show that their level of success is no less than any traditional structure, but the ownership and the wealth is much greater for the general community.
Well, it makes sense that, you know, if you're part owner of a company, you're going to work really hard to make sure it doesn't go under and that it prospers, because you're getting the dividends back to yourself instead of just making your boss's vacation nicer every week that you work. There was an interesting, I think it was a questionnaire that was sent to all the contenders for presidential nominees, not nominees yet, but the contenders for the presidential race in 2020. And it was asking them, do you think there's anything wrong with being a billionaire? Or should we do anything about people becoming billionaires in this country? And only two of them said there was anything wrong with becoming a billionaire. And I thought that said a lot, you know, about people's, where people's brainwashed sympathies seem to be, that if we protect the billionaire class and their ability to accumulate all the wealth of the society, somehow it's going to trickle down. It hasn't worked yet, and it's been 30 years, and it's just accumulating more and more into a fewer hands. But it is interesting that even the progressive so-called candidates, except for two, Sanders and Warren, were the only ones. And they didn't say we should make it illegal to be a billionaire, but they had some critique about how to tax people properly. But all the rest would not tackle it. It was like a forbidden subject. I find that interesting.
I don't. I think if you look at American culture, that answer and the idea that the myth of the American dream, the myth of pulling yourself by the bootstraps, it's so ingrained into the culture that the idea of the billionaire is not about accumulation of wealth, but the ability to continue to grow. It is a psychological little myth game that we play. But if you really deconstruct it, it doesn't work out, right? Because accumulated wealth does, we've seen it through economic studies, it doesn't represent greater well-being for the community. It doesn't create good things in general. So we have to rethink of what we mean by success. We have to rethink what we mean by return on investment. You know, all of our economic structures were developed to benefit the people with the money already in hand, right? That means that the more money you put in, the higher your return. Even if the risk to you may be minimal because you already have so much money that it really doesn't hurt you if you lose it, right? But the less money you have, the less your return, the higher your interest rate. So the system is structured in a way to benefit already those with money. If we really want to address the issue, I don't think it's about becoming or not becoming a billionaire. It's really becoming about talking about how are we distributing money. How are we distributing risk? How are we measuring risk? And who gets the benefit of taking that risk? How are we structuring our loan contracts right now, right? Why do we give the lowest rates to those most wealthy and the highest rates to those with less money? It goes back to the predatory lending piece. It's ridiculous that a low-income person has to pay 300% in order to pay the rent for a small loan for $500. And somebody with extreme wealth, you know, would probably get almost close to 0% loan because they're thinking the economic benefit of their money is going to be so much greater, when we see that that isn't the case.
Well, we have a president, Deutsche Bank, that story where they, you know, he had lost billions, millions of dollars, and they still wanted to make this giant loan to Donald Trump, you know, because he was Donald Trump, not for anything else other than it might have looked good on their portfolio and encouraged other billionaires to join them. But it wasn't because he wasn't high risk.
You know, so if the rules were really followed, it'd be a different conversation. But there is definitely favoritism, right? And the rules were built by people who always break them, quite frankly, in order to continue to benefit. And if we're talking about, is to me, is not an either or, is not a fight against who against another. It's about how do we create communities that we want? How do we take control of the, quite frankly, our money, our future, which is hard. It's hard because most of us just want to go to work, take care of the family, maybe go out for ice cream. I don't know. Most people, when you talk to them, they're not dreaming of becoming billionaires. All they want is to grow in a place that's safe, clean water, clean air, see the grandchildren, don't worry about the rent or the housing because they have it. Don't worry about being affordable healthcare because they have it. That's what they want. They don't want a yacht and an airplane, right? Most people don't want that. But we created an economy that builds towards that and everybody gets left behind with the crumbs. So for us at Ventures, what we say is, look, the question may seem really big. The problem may seem really big. But Santa Cruz County is a microcosm of the global economic troubles. We have the income gaps clearly structured. We have the education ladders and who gets where. Clearly, the separation is there. We see clearly the racial divide. Let's talk about that. The gender gap divide. women can't get childcare, and for whatever reason, women are still being the primary childcare provider for most households. So if the children have nowhere to go for affordable childcare, somebody stays home, and their careers don't advance. Right. So I think that if we look at Santa Cruz as that microcosm, whatever design or pilot we do at Ventures, we feel that there's some learning and finding that can be shared outside of this county and can be shared with others so that they can implement it, whether it is looking at how we successfully transition businesses to worker cooperatives, how do we build business wealth in other democratically owned models, how do we educate communities to take charge of their predatory lending, alternative lending maps, and address those directly? Or how do we just look at, you know, another program that we're looking at is how do we build college savings accounts for all newborns in the county, not as a measure of fixing a gap, but as a promise of the communities that we want to be.
That's a great idea. In our final couple minutes, what are some other ideas you're working on at Community Ventures? I'm speaking with Maria Cadenas. She has a lot of ideas, and of course, she's getting these also from her community. Have you talked about kind of worker-owned credit unions as well, or is that part of the picture of retaking from the banks the lending process completely?
Well, luckily, we have some credit unions here in town, so that's great. You know, one of the efforts that's going on at the state level, and I think locally there's another group working on it, was a bank that was more a public bank, you know, that allows for business-to-business lending that is more either regionally owned or state-owned and takes away that business from those that are in the speculative market. I think that makes sense. And other areas that we're looking at really closely is the area of health. Health is the number one reason for bankruptcy in this country and in this county, and we want to look at ways that we can address the well-being of our families and connect it to their financial stability.
Well, I could talk about this all year, so I hope I can have you back after you've learned more from what you're experimenting with. And I also understand you like to do music radio, so I'm going to work on having you come in and do a music show. You do women's music, so I'd love to hear your musical selections on top of all of this wisdom about the financial world that you bring to us. So let's continue the conversation offline and maybe back online here on KSQD.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. That's Maria Cadenas, Executive Director of Santa Cruz Community Ventures. Recently, I had the opportunity to talk to Tori Del Favro from the U.S. Census Bureau. We'll hear that interview in just a moment, right after this short break.
KSQD thanks Growing Up in Santa Cruz for supporting this program. Growing Up in Santa Cruz offers monthly news and views for Santa Cruz families and a calendar of local family events. Growing Up in Santa Cruz can be found for free in locations throughout Santa Cruz County. Thank you for supporting Community Radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
Hello, you're listening to Talk of the Bay. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman, and my guest today is Tori Del Favro. She is the partnership specialist with the U.S. Census Bureau. The U.S. Census Bureau has a number of different responsibilities, and among them are counting all the people in the United States, and that's important on a number of fronts. And we're going to talk about why that's important and what some of the obstacles this time around might be. Tori, welcome to Talk of the Bay.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So tell me a little bit about the history of the Census Bureau. Just give us a short snapshot of what it is that the, you know, actual mandate is.
The U.S. Constitution mandates that we do a census every 10 years. The first census was in 1790, and the decennial census helps appropriate the 435 congressional seats that each state gets. So the census is critical to get an accurate population count so we can have fair representation throughout all of the states in America.
I was thinking about this when I was driving around Northern California, and there was a town with exactly 449 people in it. And I thought, how do they know that? People move in and out. So it's a snapshot because 10 years, a lot can change.
Correct. It is a snapshot, and it's critical that we count everyone once and only once and in the right place on April 1st, 2020.
So that's not very far away from now when we're talking. How do you do that?
Well, that's part of my role as the partnership specialist. I live here locally in Santa Cruz County, and myself and my partner partnership specialist, Christina Granados, we serve Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito County. And what we do is we go out and find the trusted voices in the community and community partners and let them know how important the census is for Santa Cruz County, and letting them know their role in making sure that there's a fair and accurate count in the county. And part of that is sharing how important the census is, the 435 congressional seats that I mentioned, and also $675 billion of federal funding is based off census data. So we want to make sure that Santa Cruz County gets their fair share.
If somehow there was an undercount, what kind of programs would be affected?
Well, there's a long list of federal funded programs that we can talk about. Last night, I was at the Santa Cruz City School Board meeting and talking about the importance of the census. Federal funding does affect Title I funds and free and reduced lunches. So that really hits home with people because it's about their families. It's about their children. It's about, you know, having a full stomach to go out and learn for the day. So people really are starting to understand the importance of the census. That's why we're in a deep educational and awareness phase right now, because we want the community to understand this is more than just about numbers. It's about political representation and making sure that we have an accurate count so that all these federal programs can be funded correctly.
Has there ever been, I know there's statisticians that study these things. Has anyone ever looked back at the census and said, wow, there's a real aberration. What happened that year? Was there ever a time when it just didn't work?
Well, it's not that there was, I won't say that there was a time that it didn't work, but what I will say is that there is an acknowledgement that there was an undercount of children in the 2010 census. It's estimated that 1 million kids were undercounted in 2010, and that has big consequences. Rolling back to my meeting that I attended last night, Santa Cruz City Schools is looking at declining enrollment right now, and how do they prepare for that, and what changes do they make throughout their district to address an issue like declining enrollment. So knowing that, knowing your numbers and knowing that this is a snapshot in time really does have big consequences for the community on every level as far as transportation planning. And you think with the 0-5 population count, making sure that schools are adequately prepared for the next generation that's coming in.
Do we know anything about what happened and why children were undercounted?
There was a lot of studies on why children were undercounted. And, you know, we got a lot of different results. I think that even recently we did some kind of events have been done in the community where you're doing quizzes with people. And there's people that just truly don't understand that everyone counts, even the 0-5 population when you're filling out the census. I mean, that's the brilliance of the census is we count everyone and everyone is important. And that's the message that we're truly trying to get across with our community partners. Additionally, we want to make sure that families, you know, understand that make sure that you include your young children in your census count, because as I just stated, you know, that helps for planning with schools and other federally funded programs like Head Start.
Right. So what is the technical process of collecting all this data? Do you go door to door? How do you do it?
Well, the 2020 census is a new day. We are going to be doing the census online. And what that basically looks like is we will be doing it online. People will have the option of a paper form, and additionally, people can call in. And if people do not use any one of those three options, then an enumerator will come out in our non-response follow-up team. But what takes place, what it's going to look like for the average person is that they will get a series of 5 mailers at home. The first mailer is going to invite them to fill out the census online, and those will be mailed out in mid-March. The second mailer will also remind them to fill out the census online on the phone, or they can request a paper form. Then there's going to be a third mailer. And then the fourth mailer, if they haven't filled it out online or on the phone, a paper form will just simply be mailed home. And the fifth postcard will remind them to use one of the options, mail, phone, or online.
Sounds like you've got a lot of areas covered to try to really make sure everyone gets counted. So you have all these methods of counting. Are there, I want to get to this possible Supreme Court decision. What changes to the procedures will the U.S. Census Bureau take to ensure all residents are counted, given there's confusion right now over whether there will be a question that asks about citizenship? There are many people who fear deportation, frankly, and that is, some people say, would reduce the number of people counting themselves because they're afraid that would mean they would somehow be then next contacted by ICE. But you're counting everyone, doesn't matter citizen or not. How is this going to, just the confusion alone around it, and I don't know when the Supreme Court is scheduled to even rule on this.
Yeah, that is still in litigation, and it's a matter for the courts to decide. Whether or not the citizenship question is on the Census Bureau is prepared to go out and have a full and accurate count of everyone living in the United States. And that's part of our job as partnership specialists, is to go out and to push out into groups that work with the immigrant population, people that potentially don't have English as a first language. We're here to go out and talk about how important the census is, and additionally how that all information when people fill out the census is confidential. It's our duty. I take a sworn oath to protect all the information that I, as a Census Bureau employee for a lifetime, it's protected by Title 13. And we really need to have people understand that we do not share any of our information with any other agency. The Census Bureau is a statistical agency. Everything we report out is in the aggregate. We do not report out any personally identifiable information.
So you don't collect names and social security numbers together, or you don't collect, you know, a person's, if you are asking citizenship, you are collecting that information, but it doesn't go anywhere but the count?
We do ask, name, age, address. And those things that we ask are to make sure that we're counting everybody once and only once and in the right place. So we do collect that information. However, we do not share that information. It is protected, and for 72 years, it's sealed. I know that you can go out there and find some information from the 1940 census, but if you think about 72 years, it basically corresponds to the average lifetime. And so then the National Archives gets that information 72 years later. So people have a neat time going and looking up their ancestry and finding out information.
Has it made your job harder now that you have to do all this reassuring?
I don't know if I want to say harder. I want to say that it's made deeper connections. It has really been a pleasure to go out and connect with all these community groups. Santa Cruz is truly an amazing place. Santa Cruz truly cares about the people that are living here. They care about people's quality of life, and they care about inclusion. So it has been a fantastic journey to go out and meet all these people that are really trying to take care of our own and make sure that our local people are taken care of. And so, I don't want to use the word more difficult. I just want to say that it's, we're going to do our job. And I live here in Santa Cruz County. I grew up here. I'm raising children here. My parents live here. I take a lot of pride in Santa Cruz County, and I want to make sure that Santa Cruz gets their fair share personally.
That's a good personal motivation to have in a job like this, I'm sure. So it's going to take a lot of people to do all this. Are you hiring a big number of people, and what kind of people are you looking for?
Yes, we absolutely are hiring. We are doing an operation this summer, which is called address canvassing. That's just making sure that all of our addresses on our maps are done correctly. So we actually need people on the ground looking at those addresses and verifying the data that we have. Then next summer, we're going to have another operation with our enumerators that will be going door to door for homes that did not fill out their census online on via phone or their paper form. So we're going to be hiring hundreds of people in Santa Cruz County, and we want to hire local people that know the streets. We want to hire somebody that lives in the neighborhood that they're in the neighborhood that they're walking. You have to be 18 years old by the time you start your job. You have to be a U.S. citizen, and you have to have an email address and a social security number. So if you have those things, you are welcome to apply at 2020census.gov/jobs.
Sounds like a lot of jobs created. And are those, I think I heard you say there were summer jobs. They're going to be running for like 3 months each summer?
Yeah, it just depends on the operation. You know, we can't quite predict exactly what we're going to need right now. So that's why we're encouraging lots of people to apply. And again, we're trying to hire local people for local neighborhoods. So we're really trying to get the right person in the right spot to do this work, because we know it's important that we have somebody hired locally that really knows the neighborhood. So that is our charge, because we know the success rate with that is a lot higher. And it's really exciting to have all these local jobs pushing back into our community. It's really a neat opportunity for someone to work for the Census Bureau, to get their know their neighborhood a little bit better, and to obviously earn money.
And what is the pay range, if you don't mind me asking?
The pay range in Santa Cruz County is going to be about $20 to $22 an hour. And the real neat part about this job is that you work from home. So right when you walk out your door, you're on the clock. So it's a really nice opportunity for people to potentially blend this with another job. It's a part-time job to have some extra income. And then there's some flexibility in the schedule. So it's a nice opportunity for people in Santa Cruz County to have a little income boost.
And you're in the middle of hiring now? Is that
correct? We are in the middle of hiring right now. We are, as I mentioned before, have our address canvassing operation that's going to be taking place later this summer. And then our larger operation will be the non-response follow-up team that happens basically in late spring, early summer of 2020.
Great. Is there anything you'd like to add that we didn't get to that's about the census or its importance or anything that we missed somehow? We miss counting.
Well, I just hope that truly people understand that responding to the census is safe, it's easy, it's secure, and it's very simple. You know, taking 10 minutes of your time to fill out the census really does affect this county for the next 10 years. And so I would just really encourage everyone to fill out the census. You know, as I mentioned before, there is another person in my position in Santa Cruz County, and we are absolutely willing to go out and speak to community groups. We've talked to Capitola Aptos Rotary. We've talked to school boards. We have talked to English Learner Advisory Councils at local schools. We really want to connect with everyone in the county that's a trusted voice that understands the impact of the census and can help us get the census messaging out in the community.
And where would they go for more information?
They could easily go to 2020census.gov if they want to get more information. Additionally, the County of Santa Cruz has a website. They have a complete count committee working with it, a cross-section of schools, businesses, nonprofits, faith-based groups that have gotten together to make sure that there's a full and accurate count in Santa Cruz. And they have a website called santacruzcountycounts.us. The County of Santa Cruz has put that on.
Thank you so much. I've been talking with Tori Del Favro, Partnership Specialist with the U.S. Census Bureau and local resident here in Santa Cruz County. Thanks for being here on Talk of the Bay.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And coming up next, you're probably curious. The Santa Cruz University in our midst, UC Santa Cruz, has a brand new leader. She's the new chancellor. We're going to hear from Santa Cruz local, that's Kara Myberg-Guzman and Stephen Baxter, about their conversation they recently had with Cindy LaRive, the brand new chancellor of UC Santa Cruz.
I'm Kara Myberg-Guzman, and this is Santa Cruz Local. Cindy LaRive will become UC Santa Cruz's new chancellor next month. She'll replace George Blumenthal. As the university's top official, her decisions will shape the campus and its growth. So she'll have a big impact on the city of Santa Cruz and its housing crisis. And that's why we want to get to know her.
How long have you been in this home?
We moved in here 14 years ago.
Oh, okay.
When we came to Riverside. Maybe I can sit here?
Or... Yeah.
It's Sunday morning and I'm in Riverside. I'm at Cindy's house. It's a modest two-story Mediterranean-style home. It's at a dead end on a hill overlooking the Inland Empire. There's a for sale sign out front. Cindy moves to Santa Cruz next week. She's just had breakfast, her usual, toast. She's wearing a blue suit. We chat about her daughters and her grandchildren and their upcoming family cruise to Alaska. They're going to celebrate her 40th anniversary with her husband, Jim. I ask if I can see her home office.
To call it an office, it's a little bit an aggrandizement.
I just want to see where you work, set the scene.
Sure.
Got it.
It's a small, tidy guest bedroom. By the glass door, she set up one of those Costco folding tables with her computer and two monitors.
But I have a good view.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of light, right? We're overlooking the city of Riverside. We can, on a clear day, see about to Ontario, which is about 20 miles from here. At night, the lights come up in the city. It's really very lovely.
Currently, Cindy is the second in command at UC Riverside. She's finishing up her last few days as their provost and executive vice chancellor. Then, on July 1, Cindy becomes UC Santa Cruz's 11th chancellor. Cindy is 61. When she assumes her new role, it'll be the pinnacle of her academic career so far, after decades as a chemistry professor. She has some challenges ahead. UC Santa Cruz, like other UC campuses, faces pressure from the state to grow its enrollment. But the city of Santa Cruz is in a housing crisis, and its rental market is incredibly tight. Local leaders and voters want to limit UC Santa Cruz's growth until the campus can house more students. Also, the campus could face multiple lawsuits if the campus doesn't agree to limit the impacts of growth. It's happened before, in 2005, when the city, county, and residents sued the campus over planned growth. It may happen again. Cindy will have to navigate these pressures. I'll ask her about her views on housing. But for now, we're going outside to meet her husband, Jim. He's sitting by the pool. She warns me.
He's a ham. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Kara, and what's her name?
Cindy tells me about their stealth visit to UC Santa Cruz this spring. UC President Janet Napolitano had just offered her the position.
We were worried that, you know, maybe we wouldn't fit in Santa Cruz because we're not very fancy, but we didn't feel out of place at all. And then we drove through the campus and found some turkeys. And where we grew up in the Black Hills in South Dakota, there are a lot of deer and turkeys, and Jim can call them.
I had six or eight of them with their plumes out around our car when we went up to Santa Cruz the first time. They were my new best friends.
That pretty much sealed the deal.
To really understand Cindy and how she became an academic leader, you should know where she comes from.
Well, I'm from Deadwood, South Dakota. Some people may know the HBO series, but it's an actual place.
Her father worked in a foundry at a gold mine. He left school after third grade.
And so he didn't learn to read until he was in a retirement home.
Her mother was a secretary and had a high school degree.
All kinds of
when Cindy was 10, her parents gave her a chemistry set for Christmas.
Also had a little alcohol burner.
Cindy fell in love.
Dip a metal rod.
She would use her bed as a lab bench. One time, she accidentally set her bedspread on fire. She dreamed of becoming a high school chemistry teacher.
One day,
everything changes. It's the summer after her junior year of high school. She's working in the gold mine as a tour guide. She's in the mine with her coworkers, almost a mile underground. It's dark. It's pretty quiet, except for the water dripping and the fans whirring.
We have our hats on with lights, and we're going along through this tunnel, and we turn a corner, and there's this huge bank of computers. Now, remember, in 1976, computers were the size of my refrigerator. They had these flashing red lights, and at the end of that row of computers, there was a man there in a white lab coat.
The man is a researcher from the University of Pennsylvania. He's there to study subatomic particles in these big vats of fluid. Cindy ends up talking with him.
It was the first time I realized being a scientist is a job you can have. And he convinced me, no, you don't have to be a chemistry high school teacher unless that's what you want to do. You can go be a scientist. And so that was a life-changing moment for me.
Cindy becomes the first in her family to attend college. She earns her doctorate in chemistry from UC Riverside. After a stint at the University of Kansas, she returns to UC Riverside in 2005 as a chemistry professor. She loves mentoring students.
I avoided administrative roles for a very long time and turned down several opportunities. But in 2012, it became my turn to be the chair of the chemistry department. And to my great surprise, I liked it.
She works her way up the ladder.
Science College's dean's office as an associate dean, was interim dean, vice provost of undergraduate education, interim provost.
Then, in December, she gets a call from the search committee for UC Santa Cruz's next chancellor. They ask her to apply. She does, even though she's happy in Riverside. She doesn't think she'll get the job. But then, in March, she gets the call from Napolitano.
So I came home and I told my husband and said, I don't know what we should do. And Jim said, well, I know what we should do. We should be bold. You should go for it.
Now, with her start date just 2 weeks away, Cindy says she's trying to learn as much as she can about Santa Cruz. We take a seat in her living room. I ask her what she thinks about the city's housing crisis and the university's role in it.
The cost of housing in Santa Cruz is a real issue. And therefore, it seems to me that having the university house as many students as possible is a good thing for the community. Also reduces traffic.
Last year, Chancellor Blumenthal announced that the campus was planning for possibly 28,000 students by the year 2040. That means possibly adding 10,000 more students over the next 20 years. There was a public outcry. Many residents want the campus to stop growing. They're tired of competing with students in a tight rental market. I ask Cindy what she thinks about the 28,000 figure. She says, to be clear, that number is used for planning. It's not a goal.
I think that this 28,000 number seems reasonable to me. I think Santa Cruz, part of that growth has to be graduate students. It's not all undergraduate. Given that, the two big growth campuses for the system will be Riverside and Merced, and they can accommodate more students. But if you look at the growth trajectory of population, and you look at the number of students who want a UC education, we can't just rely on Merced and Riverside to do it all. Every campus is going to have some share. I think the other thing that we can think about, though, is not just growth in terms of headcount, in terms of number of bodies on campus, but growth in degree production. And that's a place where Santa Cruz has a big opportunity. Our four-year graduation rates are not as high as they should be. So if we can increase graduation rates, then we can create more degrees without growing as many students.
UC Santa Cruz has a history of strained relations with the city and county regarding growth. Remember those lawsuits we talked about? In 2008, the campus reached an agreement with the city, county, and residents, ending those lawsuits. The campus agreed to limit its enrollment to 19,500 students until the year 2021. It also agreed to house two-thirds of new students, a goal the campus has actually exceeded. I ask Cindy whether she thinks the campus can agree to house more than two-thirds of new students.
Don't know enough to comment about whether 100% of the students should be housed on campus or 80% or 90%. I don't know. It does make sense to me, though, that Santa Cruz, the campus, should try and house as many students as possible on campus. What that means, I can't say. I just also wonder, though, as somebody who's looking at it all from the outside, to what extent the housing pressures are all from the university. So how do we think about it in a more holistic way than just it's all the university's fault?
So what is driving UC Santa Cruz's pressure to grow? For one, the number of applications to the UC system grows each year. Admissions rates are dropping, and the UC system has not been able to keep up with California's population growth. Cindy says for California to be successful, it needs an educated workforce. So there's that, the ideal that California students who meet the standard deserve access to a UC education. Beyond that, there are financial pressures. The state has injected some cash into the UC system with the past two governor's budgets, but it's not enough to keep up with costs. That makes UC Santa Cruz depend more heavily on tuition. And that's why we've seen an increase of out-of-state and international students in the last few years. Those students pay more tuition and help the campus cover its costs. Meanwhile, the state legislature and the UC regents have been hesitant to raise tuition. UC tuition has only increased once since 2011. Add to that, certain types of state funding are tied to enrollment targets. And UC Santa Cruz is the second smallest campus in the UC system.
The university probably also has to grow just to be sustainable. There are just a number of costs and management things that don't scale linearly with the number of students. You only need one chancellor. You only need one campus provost and a dean for each of the divisions. And as you grow students, those costs don't scale, so that it can be more efficient to run the university if you're a little bit larger than we are now. I do think that some growth is probably necessary just to allow the university to be self-sustaining.
How can UC Santa Cruz house more of its students, given that state funding is not enough to build campus housing? Cindy says one solution is private-public partnerships. For example, UC Riverside is funding new student dorms with private companies. The companies will manage the dorms and share in the costs and the revenues. The partnership will result in 6,000 new student beds. UC Santa Cruz, by the way, is also entering a private-public partnership to fund the Student Housing West. It's a model that's been used successfully elsewhere. Cindy says another key is the general obligation bond that's in the works for the state ballot in March. It couldn't fund housing, but it could fund one or two new academic buildings at UC Santa Cruz. That would help students get through university faster and help limit the impacts of growth. One of the reasons why UC Santa Cruz's four-year graduation rates lag is because some students can't get into the classes they need to graduate. The facilities are too small. Riverside and Santa Cruz look at growth differently. Riverside County is the 10th most populous county in the nation. It's the fastest growing county in the state and the 5th fastest growing county in the nation. There's more land to expand in the Inland Empire. Cindy says UC Riverside is seen as an economic driver for the region. Riverside City and County want the campus to grow. Not so in Santa Cruz. As the new chancellor, Cindy will wade into a difficult relationship with the community. The public outcry about planned growth is something that Chancellor Blumenthal anticipated. Last year, he created an advisory group of about 20 politicians, business leaders, and residents. His goal was to get input on campus growth policies and hopefully ease tension. But so far, things remain unresolved. Last June, city voters approved a ballot measure that called for city leaders to oppose campus growth. Since then, the city and county have formed a task force to make sure that happens. The ballot measure had five demands for the campus. Number one, cap enrollment at 19,500 students. Number two, if growth continues, then the campus will house all new students, faculty, and staff. Number three, the campus will only grow if there's enough housing and facilities both on and off campus to support it. Number four, the campus will sign a legally binding document agreeing to build those housing units and facilities. And number five, the campus will create a funding program for those housing units and facilities. So far, the campus has been willing to listen to the community, but it's fallen short of signing anything legally binding. The community is not satisfied.
I understand that in the past there haven't been such great relationships, maybe, between the city and the campus. I hope that I can help to bridge that. I try and be a good listener and to see all sides of an issue. Even when we might not agree, I know that we can have respectful
discourse.
So when Cindy assumes her new role, the community and its leaders will be waiting to see how she responds to the pressures. We will be too. This is Santa Cruz Local. You can find us online or sign up for our email newsletter at santacruzlocal.org. Follow us on Twitter at the SC Local. My thanks to Stephen Baxter for editing this script. Music was by Poddington Bear at soundofpicture.com. I'm Kara Myberg Guzman. Thanks for listening to Santa Cruz Local.
Welcome to Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Talk of the Bay comes your way Monday through Thursday at 5 o'clock on KSQD, and I'm your Thursday host, Rachel Ann Goodman.